If you want to pump your body and expand your mind, there's only one place to go. Mind Pump. Mind Pump. With your hosts, Sal DiStefano, Adam Schaefer, and Justin Andrews.
Let me ask you this, Justin. What day does this play?
Sunday, Monday, happy days. Tuesday, Wednesday, happy days. Thursday, Friday, happy days. The weekend sign. Something to sun, working all week with you.
I think we all know who the Fonz would be.
Yeah.
So,
of course it would be me.
Yeah, Adam all the way.
Yeah, right. Yeah. No, you're Richie. Yeah. What's his name?
You're the redhead guy.
No, that's Adam.
No.
I'm definitely Fonzarelli. Come on.
Fonzarelli.
Please.
Hey.
Please. In this episode of Mind Pump, we got to interview
the man, Doctor.
A highly controversial subject online. This individual, Dr. Joseph Mercola, he has one of the most visited wellness sites.
One of
if not the most visited.
He has the
website.
By a
it's
long
the place
shot.
You go.
Yeah. Yeah. Here's the thing about Dr. Mercola. He's been around for a while, and a lot of the stuff he said back in the day that people said was crazy is now being confirmed. You know, talking about, you know, the benefit of ketogenic dieting, for example, and some of the health detriments of eating certain foods or artificial sweeteners. And but he's also known for talking about things that are not accepted at all nowadays. And so he's one of those people, one of those figures that just he can be pretty polarizing. I really enjoy Dr. Mercola's stuff. I don't necessarily agree with everything he says, only because some of the stuff he comes out with is so new that there's no way to prove it one way or the other. But I really respect the man.
Pay attention to it.
I always pay attention.
Yeah, how things have laid out, like what he said in the past, of how that's all kind of come full circle.
Well, especially nutritionally.
Well, yeah. When it comes to like being an authority on ketogenic type dieting, on cholesterol and its effects on the body, on saturated fats, you know, things that have been demonized for so long.
Great book, Fat for Fuel.
Fat for Fuel is his book. It's a new one, which is, and it's pretty cool. I've looked into it. It's actually a very
good
book.
Get it through our audible.com.
We got it there. Excellent. Yep. But he's like an authority on some of those subjects, and I've gone through, this is a guy that I reference, I should say, quite a bit when it comes to certain subjects. So somebody that we've respected and known about for a very, very long time. So it was exciting to have him on the show to talk about a lot of these different things. For those of you who don't know, he's an alternative medicine proponent, an osteopath physician. He's a real doctor, a web entrepreneur. And again, his website, Mercola.com, is the most visited natural health website online. So it's massive, massive. He's got lots and lots of people reading his stuff, and a lot of, again, what he does is criticizing many of the aspects of standard medical practice. Also, we have we launched our new program, MAPS Prime Pro, which is truly a correctional-based program. What that means is it's not a workout per se. It's something that is designed to help you self-assess your body and figure out what you need to do to get better recruitment patterns, to correct muscle imbalances, to alleviate pain, to get your body moving better when you do your workouts. It's in great detail. It covers parts of the body that most, or actually no programs cover. I don't know of any other program.
This was really our answer.
Not a fitness program.
This was really our answer. Like all of our programs have been an answer to somebody else or a majority of people doing things poorly. Mm-hmm. This is our answer to like a lot of bad chiropractors out there. Chiropractors that have people come in and they have joint pain and dysfunction and they just adjust them and say, come back the next couple of days, see me three times a week over the next 6 months. Instead of that and just prescribing them, getting popped into place to feel better.
Or even just bad personal trainers who don't know how to do a proper assessment, or even the assessment that you're taught as a trainer is super, super general. I mean, MAPS Prime Pro covers the wrist and hands, the neck, the lumbar spine, the hips, the shoulders, the shoulder blades, the feet, the toes, the ankles. So it gets into depth in all these areas, and we were able to recruit Dr. Justin Brink, who's one of the most impressive movement specialists that we've ever worked with, to design Prime Pro. And of course, we have another program called MAPS Prime, which is a self-assessment program for teaching you how to prime your workouts. And what we've done is we've combined both programs in our Prime bundle and discounted them tremendously. So you can do the Prime bundle. You can get MAPS Prime and MAPS Prime Pro for a big discount, and you can get them both at mindpumpmedia.com. So without any further ado, here's Dr. Mercola. Now, Dr. Mercola, real quick, tell us a little bit about how you got started. Now, you are a licensed physician. You also have one of the largest followings online in the health and wellness sphere, period, if not the top visited.
Well, it is the largest in health and wellness, for the last 13 years.
How many people do you reach? Do you know numbers of how many people you reach or what your reach looks like?
We have 15 million unique visitors every month.
Wow.
Wow, that's absolutely incredible. A lot of influence. You have a tremendous amount of influence.
Right.
What got you started in this? What made you decide to go from, you know, being a doctor where you're working with patients to, you know, writing books, getting online, and really spreading out some of the things that you talk about?
Well, it's just primarily an integration of two of my passions, which is health and the other is technology. I took my first computer programming class in 1968. So I've been passionate about both of those fields, but I never really had time once I went to medical school to go into technology. I was obsessive compulsive about getting that information down. But once I graduated and started my practice, then I started back into it again. And then in the mid-90s, the internet came out, and well, actually not the internet. The internet was developed in 68, but the web, which was the graphical user interface to access the net. And about 2 years later, I started my website. So we've been on doing this for about 20 years now. And it initially was motivated by a desire to find out the information sources that my patients were coming to me with and telling me news before I found it, because I was in the office practicing all day and they were home watching TV. And I realized that the newscasters were getting it from the internet, and I could do the same thing and put my spin on it. And I thought if I liked it, someone else would. And so I just started creating a newsletter in the late 90s.
Excellent. Now, you're known for being quite polarizing, controversial. You've been on one side, people say you speak the truth. You're very, in many ways, very counter to accepted Western, medical advice. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, people have called you everything from a quack to a charlatan. Why do you think that is? Why are you so counter? I mean, is this something that happened early on as a doctor, where you were taught certain things and they just didn't make sense with what you were seeing in your practice?
Well, I've always been interested in health, and unfortunately was manipulated and deceived when I went to some brainwash, essentially, when I went to med school and wound up prescribing lots of drugs to my patients, and eventually recognized, as most physicians who are honest, that model fails miserably, that it never hardly ever addresses the core foundational issues of what's causing disease. So then I started exploring other options. And once you start getting successes in those areas that essentially offer alternatives, competitive alternatives to the conventional system, then you start receiving lots of discrediting campaigns hurled at you, which they certainly hurled at me in massive forces. That's not a strategy that they're just focusing on me. They've done it historically through, and not just in medicine or health, but in a wide variety of other disciplines. That's the strategy, is that the incumbents tend to hurl these discrediting campaigns, and the truth gets buried, essentially. So I've literally, through the information I've exposed, cost these large major corporations tens of billions, with a B, dollars in losses to their bottom line net revenues. So if any good business would be, they're going to seek to stop the leaks.
Yeah, that's why they're pissed off.
The most common strategy is discrediting, in which they're pretty skilled at. I mean, they've got loads of resources to access some of the sharpest and cleverest minds on the planet and how to do this. So, you know, they're relatively effective getting their point across.
Doc, is there a time, an article, or a moment in your career when you really knew that this is what's happening? So in other words, like when you first put out something that was controversial, when did you really first feel the heat from others that were trying to suppress what you were trying to get out there?
I really can't recall a specific incident. It's a whole wide variety of them. But the one that I can recall is vitamin D. When I first started explaining to people how important this was in the early 2000s, like 2001 or so, 2000 even. And there was a lot of pushback on that and saying, no, you're crazy. And then there was another issue with, of course, we know that's the case. That's actually one area where I was able to catalyze the transformation of the perspective, even in conventional medicine. So at least vitamin D now is recognized as a very important therapeutic adjunct. Unfortunately, almost all conventional physicians think that the way to get vitamin D levels normalized is through swallowing it, which is exactly the wrong strategy. But at least they understand that it's important. So that's a step in the right direction. Then omega-3 fats was another issue. Then, of course, the old vaccines, which is highly controversial and really the area of healthcare that almost every physician will fail to embrace until the very end. And that's how you know someone who's really made the conversion is that they realize the challenges with the whole model of using vaccines to improve the immune system.
Doc, share with our audience that might not know that history of vitamin D and how you've brought that to the forefront. What was it that old ways were talking about this or neglecting to talk about this, and what exactly?
Well, back in, it may not seem, but even today, there's still some physicians who don't understand this, but the RDAs were like 200 or 400 units of vitamin D, which is essentially an insignificant dose. And anyone who would even think or dream of recommending a dose much higher, 1,000 units, and, what many people prescribe now today, 20 or 50,000 units, should have their license reprimanded because it was going to kill people. So there was this strong reluctance to really adopt any type of therapeutic benefit. And of course, the old dogma that the sun is dangerous, which exists to this very day, that if you go out in the sun without slathering your skin with sunscreen, you're going to come down with cancer, which wouldn't. And the irony is it's the actual opposite, that avoiding the sun and using skin or sunscreen, at least most conventional sunscreens, will actually increase your risk of cancer.
Now, what is wrong with the why is that? Is it because low vitamin D increases risk of cancer, or is it because of the chemicals that are in the chemical-based sunscreens that can also increase risk of cancer, or is it both?
It's both. It's actually both, yeah. There's no question that epidemiologically there is an incredible strong correlation between vitamin D levels and the risk of cancer. In fact, most of the analysis suggests that it will reduce your cancerous optimized vitamin D levels by 50%. That's a significant reduction considering that cancer is heading towards the number one cause of death in the U.S. in the next 6 years or so.
What is some practical advice then that you give to people, Doc? Then is it, how much sunshine should you be exposed to on a daily basis? And I know it's different for everybody based off of...
Yeah. You just have to give guidelines because you're absolutely correct. There's about a dozen different variables that contribute to the amount of dosage you should get based on the time of year, the time of day, season, your latitude, cloud cover, a wide variety of things. But essentially, if you're Caucasian and you have relatively white skin, you want to go outside, at least initially, until your skin turns the lightest shade of pink, which is also called the MED, the minimal erythema dose, which could be as little as 2 minutes in some people. I mean, you can't give a specific recommendation. And it may be 4 hours in a deeply pigmented African American. Hmm. But obviously, they're not going to be able to tell if they've got a pinkish skin because they're not going to be able to see it. But so the dose can be widely varied. I myself live in the east coast of Florida and typically walk about 90 minutes a day on the beach. And the time varies based on the year. So this time of year, I'll be out early in the morning, try to get in before 10 o'clock and and sometimes even before 8 or 9 o'clock. But in the winter, it'll be around solar noon.
Now, Dr. Mercola, and I want to be clear with our audience, by the way, because we're going to get into the more controversial subjects that you have opinions on right now. They're considered very controversial now. But I want the audience to know that that piece of advice that you just gave was extremely controversial not that long ago. Now, today, it's right. becoming more mainstream. In fact, I just read a study that showed that sunburn, they didn't even correlate sunburn to certain types of melanoma, but they did correlate and associate using sunscreen with them. So now it's starting, people are starting to look at it. But back, 15 years ago, it was extremely controversial. One of the other things, and one of the ways that I found you, was when I was doing my research a decade ago on saturated fat and cholesterol intake. And back when you were talking about saturated fats and cholesterols, it was completely accepted that both were very bad for you.
Right.
And now it's much more mainstream now. Now more studies are showing that it's not that big of a deal.
Yeah, I was on Dr. Oz in an argument with him. He was claiming, and I think he's a cardiologist. I think he is, or cardiovascular surgeon. But he was claiming the saturated fat. He drank Kool-Aid and was claiming that it was this major contributor to heart disease. And when in fact now we know it's not, and fortunately, a progressively increasing number of professionals are starting to accept that. But that's the history. I adopt these. I'm not sure why it is, but I'm able to understand these perspectives earlier than mothers typically, and it's validated by the science that's out there. And I catch a lot of flack for exposing it, but eventually people realize it was true. So unfortunately, we're still not there in a lot of the positions I hold. So
now let's talk about saturated fat for a second, if you don't mind. Saturated fat does in some people, and many people in fact, especially if you eat a lot of it, you will increase your total cholesterol numbers, and some people increase their LDL numbers, at least the way we test them. And you've said that's not a bad thing. Why?
Well, it's not always true, especially if you're having things like coconut oil, because although coconut oil may increase it, but I found a very high saturated fat diet. My cholesterol like rarely over 130 or 140. And I'm not saying that's good. I think the ideal cholesterol is probably closer to 200, maybe even a little bit higher. Really, total cholesterol is a very poor predictor of heart disease. You really have to do the subfractions of the cholesterol particles and the fractions and to make a better assessment. A simple ratio would be either HDL or total cholesterol ratios, but it's, to just use total cholesterol as a marker is not that wise. But in fact, if you look at the studies, low cholesterol is probably a pretty strong indicator of developing certain types of chronic degenerative diseases like cancer.
You said about particle sizes. Let's talk about LDL, the bad cholesterol. Is there, what's the difference? What are we talking about? We talk about particle sizes.
Well, you can do something called NMR analysis. And, it's not one of my specialties. I haven't seen patients for 10 years now, but I don't recall the specific details because that analysis was developed after I stopped seeing patients. But you can look at those up, and there's healthy ranges, and you can more accurately predict your likelihood of developing cardiovascular disease.
Okay. One thing I noticed as an athlete is when I increase my dietary cholesterol intake, I notice I get much stronger in the gym, at least in the short term. Is that something that people can expect to feel when they increase their dietary cholesterol? What's the role that it plays in muscle adaptation or strength?
Well, I don't know that dietary cholesterol plays a significant role one way or the other. Most of the cholesterol is made in your body. It's not ingested through your diet.
Okay.
So it's really more the macronutrient ratios. So the percentages of fat, carbohydrate, and protein. And that's really what I discuss in my new book, Fat for Fuel, which was the best-selling nonfiction book in the United States last week.
Excellent. Congratulations.
So, all right.
You recommend people go on a high-fat, very low-carbohydrate, moderate kind of protein diet. Do you recommend that for most people?
No, it's actually a lot more complex than that.
Okay.
Run into some complications when you simplify it. But basically, it's a cyclical ketogenic diet, which fortunately a lot of people in the paleo community are starting to appreciate. But it's so it's initially what you described is correct. It's a relatively low, but at the same time adequate amount of protein, which is one of the biggest mistakes most paleo people make. They have too much protein. And there's no doubt in my mind for a whole variety of reasons why that's important. One of the primary ones is that if it's influence on this signaling pathway called mTOR, mechanistic target of rapamycin. And when you activate that with large amounts of protein, which is the primary way that it's activated, you can have some long-term complications. Not that you want to chronically suppress it, just like you don't want to chronically suppress insulin. But when you do that initially, because most people, 70% of the country is overweight, and at least a third or 40%, depending which state you live in, are obese. So those individuals would benefit from this transitional phase, which could take anywhere from a few weeks to a few months to shift their metabolism, burning fat as a primary fuel instead of burning glucose, which it will have significant long-term complications if you don't change that. I believe it's one of the primary reasons why most people are just getting sick and dying prematurely, developing all these diseases that really were unheard of like a century or two ago, or were very rare at the least.
So you're saying that people's bodies constantly burning glucose for energy is causing lots of chronic disease. Why is that?
Well, it's primarily because the efficiency at which that fuel is burned. So carbohydrates have when you eat food, it's converted to breakdown products that are essentially shuttled to your cell and then into your mitochondria. And once you have those breakdown products, they essentially transfer electrons to the electron transport chain to ultimately to oxygen. That process is called aerobic respiration through the Krebs cycle, and it generates your energy, your ATP. And when you do that as primarily supplying substrate from the glucose, you're going to generate 30 to 50% more reactive oxygen species as that shuttles to the electron transfer chain. And the downside of that, it's not that you don't need any reactive oxygen species, you need to suppress it to zero with antioxidants, but when you have excessive reactive oxygen species, you generate free radicals, and the free radicals, with excessive free radicals, will cause damage to mitochondrial and cellular DNA, proteins, and cell membranes. And that is what causes the premature damage. So we want to normalize the amount of reactive oxygen species or oxidative species that we're exposed to. And diet is one, and there's a whole wide variety of other strategies that I discuss in my book, but diet is one of the most important.
Now, when you say that, Doc, if I were to be following a low-carb diet and I have a day where I eat over my typical intake. So let's say I stay under 50 or under 100 grams of carbohydrates per day, and then all of a sudden I have a day where I go overboard and I have 200-400 grams of carbs. Is there any benefit to taking a supplement like an antioxidant on that day because of that, from what you're saying right now with the free radicals?
That's an interesting question. I haven't reflected on it, but my guess is no. Maybe some. It's kind of like smoking. And when you say carbs, I'm assuming you're referring to net carbs, which is total carbs minus the fiber, because if you're eating 200 grams of broccoli, the net carbs in that might be 20.
Exactly.
So it's really the net carbs that cause the issue. I don't know, at least Tim Noakes, who's really a well-respected pioneer in this field, I'm sure you've heard of him, and I've interviewed him in the past, and he's in South Africa and then a physician there. And he's pretty strong, and he was a big time advocate of high carb. He's a long endurance athlete. He's not a strength training athlete, but he's firmly convinced that very few, hardly anyone, needs more than 150, 200 grams of carbohydrates in any day. But the primary component of your question, though, is that if you're is making an assumption that you already are burning fat for fuel, and you guys are pretty healthy, you're fit, and so my guess is you have that metabolic flexibility. So that when you at that level, most people, probably even most people listening to your podcast have this flexibility, but most people in the country don't. Probably 90% or more. So once you have the flexibility, though, you need to take those days. And I'll bet you guys would be interested to know why you need to have those high-carb days and high-protein.
Hmm. Yeah, I'd love to know why.
Would you like to know?
Absolutely.
Hardly any physicians don't understand this. And I didn't either before I started writing my book and collaborating with about two dozen professionals, experts in the field who helped me write the book. So it's not just my wacky ideas in there. It's, you know, it's a collaboration of some really high-powered healthcare professionals. But one of these guys pulled up an article for me written in the 90s that shows the mechanism of insulin. And most people believe that insulin works by driving glucose into the cell. You guys probably believe that too, I would think,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
We do.
That's what you're told. That's what you're taught. But that's not the way, that's not its primary mechanism. Its primary mechanism is actually much different. It really explains why you need to do cyclical ketogenesis. Its mechanism is that it suppresses the liver's ability to make glucose, a process called hepatic gluconeogenesis.
Hmm.
So when your insulin levels get really low, as you do when you do keto, which is a good thing for almost everyone in the country because their insulin resistance, high insulin levels is really one of the primary reasons why most people die prematurely, high insulin resistance. So, but when you're insulin, if you over-treat, as you do it with your chronic keto and you have really high insulin levels, the insulin cannot shut the liver from making or stop or really significantly impair it from making glucose. So what does that mean? It means you're eating 5-10 grams of net carbs and your blood sugar is rising. But you're eating 0 net carbs and your blood sugar rises because your brain and your nervous tissue need sugar, so your liver makes it. And the interesting irony is, or the paradox is, that when you eat a piece of fruit or a healthy carb, your blood sugar will actually drop when you're in this metabolic state because it increases insulin and insulin finally shuts off the liver from making glucose. And I actually found this out myself. I experienced it. I was doing chronic keto. It was probably for 6 months. I was losing weight. My muscle mass was going down. It looked terrible. It looked like it was a starvation camp. So I knew I needed a tweaking. I didn't understand what the tweaking was because what, you know, in theory I was doing the right thing, but I didn't understand the fact that it has to be cyclical. And you need to stimulate, you know, once you're in ketosis, you need that to stimulate and ramp up that insulin level and actually build muscle tissue, you know, increase GF1, AMPK, and, you know, have that metabolic stimulus. And the similar, that's the process for carbs and insulin, but a similar process occurs for protein and mTOR. So normally, almost everyone overeats protein, and it's the rare person who needs more than 60 grams in one day. And if you continue to take high levels of protein, there's just little doubt in my mind that you're going to die prematurely. And I've known that for a while, but I thought it was largely due to mTOR. But if you're getting high amounts of protein, especially from animal protein, Stephen Gundry, who wrote the book Plant Paradox, which is just published, has some really interesting data in there that shows there's these types of sugars that are in meats that actually develops or stimulates this autoimmune reaction in us when we eat large amounts of them. So and it can cause cardiovascular disease. So it's not that animal proteins are to be avoided, but excess animal proteins, like excess of anything, can lead to some serious complications.
So how often would you recommend someone go in and out of ketosis, a normal, healthy individual?
Well, it's based on your own circumstances. A general guideline is about twice a week or maybe three times, and typically to be done in conjunction with the days that you're strength training. You know, I have not seen you guys, but I'm sure you guys are like...
We're buffing. Yeah, we're buffing gorgeous.
I'm a big fan of that. I don't have large muscle masses. It's not because I don't want to. I just, you know, just haven't been able to do that. But I'm a big proponent of strength training. So those days when you're doing that is to really, that's when you increase your carbs and your protein so that you can have that anabolic stimulus to support your muscle growth or increase muscle growth.
Yeah. Have you
talked about blood flow restriction training yet?
Yeah, we actually have a guide on BFR.
Oh, yeah, maybe. Yeah, I got to get that because that is like the hottest new thing now. I just really learned about it recently. I think I listened to Ben Greenfield's podcast.
Yeah,
and started
Ben's a good
researching
buddy.
It. That thing is amazing. Yeah, it's an amazing tool that everyone needs to access.
Extremely fascinating to all of us. We actually came across it maybe a year and a half, 2 years ago. We wrote a guide not long after it because once we'd read up on it, then we all applied it ourselves and we're just extremely fascinated in the benefits.
Yeah, I mean, it's less beneficial for guys like you already super fit, but the massive potential is for those who are injured or the elderly
who can get the benefits
without having to kill themselves.
That's what we saw. We saw that because I can't imagine, I can't tell you how many people I've rehabbed from a knee surgery or a back surgery, an issue where I'm concerned about how much I'm loading, you know, an exercise where now being able to tie them off like that with little to no weight and get some of the same benefits as if we were lifting twice as much or four times as much weight is just incredible. So,
Beautiful tool. It needs to be popular because hardly any people know about it outside of the fitness community.
So I want to ask you a little bit more about the protein and you saying that, you know, when you say that the average person probably doesn't need even more than 60 grams, when you say that we're talking about overall health, correct? Like if you were, you know,
yes. If your goal, obviously people have different goals. When I was referencing people who are seeking to have longevity and optimal health as their goal. And if you have a different goal and you want to be a bodybuilder or some other thing, you're going to exchange that. So you're going to exchange that goal for some of the health benefits because I think you're sacrificing if you have long-term chronic protein excess. So you can do pulsing, but if you have continuous, your body needs a break. It's just you can't be slamming on the accelerator continuously without having negative long-term consequences.
This is totally anecdotally speaking here, but this has been very fascinating for myself. So I'm a bodybuilder myself. I'm an IFBB pro men's physique athlete. I took the last 2 years off, and I've been intuitive eating, and I just got back to tracking. And during this time that I was intuitive eating, I was grossly under eating protein. Now I still maintain a pretty healthy.
What were those numbers?
I was getting down between 60 to 80 grams. I'm a 220 pound guy, so I'm 200.
Yeah, yeah. That would be you know. I was referring to the general population, but someone in your weight size, 80 grams would be the minimum because you have a lot more muscle mass.
Right. So I was down in that lower end where when I'm competing, I'm more like 200 to 220 grams of protein that I'm consuming. What was fascinating to me is I can already, and I've been back at it for about a week and a half now, and just by moving my protein up to about 150 to 180 grams a day, especially on my weight training, I can see myself putting on muscle. I feel like my body is way more responsive to the protein than what it was before. And I come from an era too that, you know, I've been lifting for well over 15 years and in the industry for a long time. I mean, I used to be the guy that was trying to get 2.5-3 grams of protein per pound and was just way, way over consuming it because back then, and we talk about this on the show all the time that, you know, if you've been, as long as you've been around that, you know, protein is the max. If you want to be a big bodybuilder, you got to eat lots of protein.
Oh, yeah.
That was a major paradigm shattering moment for me, was realizing that I didn't need that much. And in fact, I can feel how much better my body feels that I went really low. And then now reintroducing a more moderate to higher level of protein, I feel like it's way more responsive than being oversaturated. Can you explain maybe what I'm feeling or what I'm going through?
Yeah, is there a protein desensitizing effect from constantly consuming large?
Yeah. Well, we don't, as far as I'm aware of, the studies haven't been done, but I'm pretty confident that there is. And the analogy would be very similar to insulin. So if you have lots of carbs all the time, and we see that all year, a third of the country has diabetes or prediabetes, right? So that's what happens. You get insulin resistance, you get secondary diabetes and all the pathology that follows with that. Similarly, if you eat high amounts of protein, which I personally, as does Ron Rosedale, who's one of my nutritional mentors, believes that excess protein is probably more dangerous than excess carbs.
Wow.
Because not only will it impact insulin additionally, which is also another potentially detrimental metabolic pathway, but it will impact the mTOR. And mTOR is a nutrient signaling pathway. And we unfortunately don't have the ability to measure. We can measure IGF as a downstream consequence of that. So you don't want elevated IGF levels online, but you develop a sense of relative, a physiological resistance, which I think is what you experience. When you cut the protein down, the mTOR became more sensitive. Mm. So you had, I suspect you were developing mTOR resistance, even though that term is not, that doesn't exist. That's what I would call it. Uh-huh. And you anecdotally observed the benefit. It's exactly what you would predict.
Yeah, now, I've experienced exactly the same thing, and in fact, for the last few years, I incorporate a low protein day, almost like a protein fast, every once in a while. Sometimes once a week, where I'll just eat vegetables, some fats, and I'll eat very, very little protein once a week. And I notice when I do that, and this is my own anecdote, but I seem to build more muscle with my regular protein intake the day after.
Sure. No, that's again what you would predict. And there's, you know, that brings another strategy you can use to improve your mitochondrial function, which is intermittent or even longer term fasting, which I believe that we were all designed to do, but hardly anyone does nowadays. Mm-hmm. Certainly the 70% of people overweight need to seriously consider that strategy. Mm-hmm. I mean, and it saves them money. It's not like you would tell them to buy a supplement, you know, you
just right.
Don't eat.
That's so. We wrote a fasting guide that has six different protocols inside of it. So that was another thing that was a paradigm shattering moment for a bunch of bodybuilder muscle guys like ourselves that saw the benefit of incorporating fasting. Because if you would have told me that 10 years ago as a 20-year-old skinny kid trying to build muscle, I would have thought you're crazy. There's no way I'm going to not eat for a day. I'll have all this muscle fall off my body.
Yeah. Well, but if you were an authentically skinny kid, to do that for a long time is not going to work either. You do need the exercising to get the protein and the carbs up periodically because, chronically it won't work. You've got to have that cycling again. That's what it is. The cycling is so essential to staying healthy. And in fact, exercise is metabolic stress, right? Mm-hmm. Clearly, there's no question. You cause damage to your body when you exercise. When does the benefit occur? It occurs in recovery, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you exercise continuously, are you going to get stronger and healthier? No, you're going to dig yourself into a hole and you'll get injured and decrease your health. So the magic occurs in recovery. Similarly, the magic occurs in the refeed. So when you go into this fasting or ketogenic cycle, low carb, low protein, that's like exercise. It's a metabolic stress. I mean, it definitely is relatively unhealthy, but when you recover and you have the higher carbs and higher protein, that's where the metabolic magic occurs and you get all the benefits, which you guys are seeing anecdotally. Mm. It's on the refeed. That's where the magic happens. But you don't get that benefit if you haven't done the stressor before. So it's like trying to be in recovery continuously. You'll never get big, right? You got to get that stressor in there with the exercise.
Now, in our world, it's also been advocated to eat very, very frequently throughout the day. And the rationale was you burn more body fat if you eat six meals a day versus three or two. It's better for you. I've read articles that actually show the opposite and, in fact, show that there may be an inflammatory response to eating super frequently. Is this something you've looked into yourself?
Well, I think it might be targeted to a specific nutrient, protein. If you eat a lot of protein regularly, I think it's going to be a problem. But I think as long as you're restricting your intake of calories to a window, I think ideally it's like about 6 hours. So I personally try to only eat within a 6-hour window. Mm. And so then it doesn't matter. I could be eating 5-6 meals in that 6 hours. I eat once every hour, but I'm not eating for 18 hours.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm. Now, you had brought up cancer and how cancer is looking to be probably the leading cause of death. And the old model or the current model says that a lot of cancer is genetic. A lot of it has to do with our genes and mm-hmm. mutations.
That's the belief of conventional physicians and oncologists. That is correct.
Right. And you...
It's true, but that's their belief.
Well, why isn't it true? Because I've heard of there's the metabolic reasoning behind cancer and causes of cancer.
Well, I didn't figure this out. I mean, there's brilliant people before me, specifically Thomas Seyfried, the professor of biology at Boston College, who wrote The Metabolic Theory of Cancer. And he can go into great detail why that is. But essentially, there is genetic damage. There's no question. There's a wide panoply of incredible diversity of genetic mutations that occur. None of them are really consistent. But they're not a result. That's not what causes the cancer directly. They're an indirect consequence of mitochondrial dysfunction, metabolic mitochondrial dysfunction, and that causes downstream secondary nuclear genetic damage and mutations. So that's what causes it. So if you go in fact, Seyfried has done some really fascinating work where he compiled a lot of the early research. I don't think he did the research himself, but he compiled it, stuff that was done 20, 30 years ago. And the researchers had no idea how to interpret these findings, but they would take the mitochondria from a cancer cell and put them into a normal cell, and that cell would develop cancer. And then they would take the mitochondria from a normal cell and put them into a cancer cell, and the cancer would just go away.
Wow.
You know, which, and it was a wide variety. He describes it more articulately and in greater detail. And there was a wide variety of research in this. He compiled it and published a paper on it. And to me, that was pretty clear evidence that it was the mitochondria that's the key here. It's not the genetics. And, you know, we're seeing incredible recoveries from people who are following these strategies and protocols. You know, we're just beginning, because it's just literally a handful of researchers are using these clinically. And there's probably less than 1,000, 2,000 patients who have been applied, and maybe a little bit more, but not much. And they're having incredible remissions. So we're at the beginning of a radical transformation where we're going to treat cancer.
What are some of the best things that we can do to prevent cancer for ourselves? I mean, maybe you could start with diet, which I mean, I'm sure diet probably plays the biggest role, and then maybe talk about some of the other causes.
Yeah. With diet, you know, it's that mTOR again, the mechanistic target of rapamycin. Rapamycin, what is it? It's a cancer drug. It was discovered from the Easter Island of Rapa Nui. That's what it's named after. And one of the most effective cancer drugs, actually. And how does it work? It suppresses mTOR. So, but what works even better than rapamycin? Not having a lot of protein.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
So if you want to suppress cancer, because when mTOR is activated, it suppresses a metabolic process called autophagy, which means self-destruction. It's removal of all these senescent, damaged cells that have to be taken out. And they can't be when mTOR is activated, or they can't be effectively. So you want to keep mTOR in balance, just like you want to have really good insulin sensitivity. You do not want insulin resistance. You don't want essentially mTOR resistance. You want it to be sensitive. So that's a key thing. But there's a whole variety of other strategies. Toxins are important. You know, we're exposed to so many things. So you want to eat organic. You want to stay away from glyphosate and Roundup. Fluoride in the water supply is a metabolic poison. So you want to drink clean water and lead and cesium and thallium. There's just all these different things. So a good detox program is helpful. And then EMF radiation or non-native EMF radiation, which is essentially artificial. So our cell phones, our Wi-Fi, our cell phone towers are two huge variables that we need to take control over. I mean, I am talking to you on a phone, but I'm holding my phone literally 3 feet away from my body because I purchased a microwave meter, and that's the radiation that comes out of your cell phone. It's usually in a few hundred megahertz to gigahertz range. And you can actually measure it digitally, not hard to do. You can see that the radiation when you hold the phone is like hundreds, and I literally mean hundreds. This is not a hyperbole or gross exaggeration. It's hundreds of times higher at the phone when you're calling it than it is 2 feet away from you. So wow. Holding the phone to your head is an assurance that you are going to rapidly decrease your longevity.
That makes me feel so good now that I never answer my phone, Doc.
So I should keep it away from my balls.
I only text people, so that makes me feel so much better now. See, now you know why, Sal.
Yeah,
I never
answer
my phone.
You're still holding the phone, though, when it's connecting with the cell phone tower. And it's not, you know, the worst thing to do is put it next to your head, and it's even worse for kids because their skull is so much thinner. And their brain has more water, so it's more susceptible to this damage. But what happens is that there's a resonance that occurs, and these microwaves cause the production of something called a reactive nitrogen species called peroxynitrate, and that causes the production of hydroxyl free radicals, which again causes the whole mitochondrial dysfunction, which can lead to the cancer. So it's not just cancer where you're holding the phone next to you. And that certainly it happens. People who put them in their hip pocket, or a lot of women get breast cancer and they put it in their bra, or, you know, obviously people holding it to their head. But it has a systemic effect too. It can definitely damage you systemically. So that's a key thing that is so easy to control. You know, just keep away from the damn cell phone, turn off your Wi-Fi at night. I mean, how simple can it be? You know, and I actually sleep in a EMF canopy that is some sheer drapery-like fabric that's composed of cotton, silver, and copper threads that essentially it's a Faraday cage. And, you know what the microwave radiation I measure in there is when I go to sleep at night?
What is it?
It's 0.0. No radiation comes through.
That's like Ben Greenfield's. Cool. Ben Greenfield's house is built this way.
I know. That's probably why you guys like each other. Yeah.
Well, you know, I actually wrote Ben this morning. He's got that Aura ring, and he thinks that he puts an airplane mode and he's safe. And I actually just measured it last night, and it's like 1 to 2 microwatts per square centimeter. And normal is like 0.03, so it's like 30, 40 times higher than ambient.
Oh, wow.
So
he's got to step his game up.
You don't know until you measure. You just don't know. So you can get these meters. They're not too expensive, a few hundred bucks.
Well, you find them on Amazon? Where can you get them?
Your environment.
Where do you find these meters?
This is a microwave meter. The best one I've seen is called the TES593. And you just look it up on Google Shopping. And they're about $350. So the Amazon doesn't sell it. Mm. I don't know why, but they don't. So, because normally it's like retails for like $500, but you can get it for $350.
Now, question.
And the unit you want to use is microwatts per square centimeter, okay, which is like the fourth unit that they do. It's a standard that's done in the U.S.
Now, obviously, nowadays, you know, Wi-Fi and cell phones are everywhere. You think we're going to see...
Mm-hmm.
A lot of increased rates of cancers as a result of that, especially in children?
Well, I think you're going to see a whole wide variety of things. I mean, certainly autism could be one on the one end, and the other end is you have neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's and ALS and Parkinson's. So, yeah, you're going to see this generalized increase in all these chronic degenerative diseases. So, it's like smoking. You know, it's not one exposure that's going to get you. It's this chronic, decade-long exposure that's going to has consequences.
And what can people do to protect themselves?
Well, never put your phone in your body. This is an airplane mode, that's for sure. Airplane mode pretty much cuts off most of the concern. Turn off your Wi-Fi at night would be another key thing. Yeah, I mean those are the two strategies that will radically reduce.
What about these cases that they sell for? What about these cases that they sell?
No,
for
they don't work. They don't work. They don't work, as far as I can tell. They may have some biological benefit in the way that the radiation reacts with your body, but you can get this meter and measure it yourself. I was just purchased something. Someone on my forum wrote earlier last week that this material, it's like a meteorite that crashed in Russia called Shungite, was supposed to absorb these EMFs, and they even had a video showing how they held this meter up to the microwave and it reduced it. And I said, well, that's not impressive. So I ordered it. It didn't work at all. Touch it. So you don't have to trust anyone, you know, because, you know, you can measure it yourself.
Right.
You know, just you know, figure it out.
Now, earlier,
easy to do nowadays.
Earlier you had mentioned glyphosates, which are the herbicides that are sprayed on GMO foods. Why? What are some of the reasons people should eat organic and avoid GMO?
Even non-GMO foods, like wheat, which is not GMO, but it's typically sprayed with glyphosate or Roundup as a desiccant to kill it, so it's easier to harvest. Organic typically avoids most of those, and also not always, because, you know, there's these large corporations, they always figure out the loopholes and ways to game the system, you know, so, you know, they could still be organic and get away with it and not be ideally grown, but, you know, in ideal circumstances. I think biodynamic is better. The Demeter certification, which were actually, it was based on Rudolf Steiner's work. But when you have food that's ideally grown, it's more nutrient dense. You know, it has the minerals in there in the right form, and, you know, it's going to be healthier for you. But even healthy food, there's, if you guys heard of Stephen Gundry, G-U-N-D-R-Y?
No.
Oh, he's an MD. He wrote the book, The Plant Paradox.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
Yeah. So Ben's going to interview him soon. I'm going to interview him in the fall, I think. But really interesting components. So a lot of healthy foods like that we think are healthy, like certain vegetables like cucumbers or nightshades and tomatoes have these lectins in there, these proteins, which impair your biology. And if you consume them in large quantities, even though they appear to be healthy, and whole grains, I mean, almost all the grains and beans, you know, they have these lectins that can really sabotage your health. So, yeah, I think that's really another important strategy that I wasn't particularly aware of when I wrote the book, but if I had, I probably would have integrated it into my book, Fat for Fuel.
Now, what's the problem with non-organic foods with glyphosates? What do they do to the body that's so bad?
Oh, gosh, that's a good question. They do a lot of things. Well, first of all, they're chelators and they're antibiotics. And so that would mean they chelate out important minerals like zinc and manganese. And then they can impair your beneficial bacteria in your gut. But I think probably one of the worst things they do is they decimate these tight junctions in your gut epithelial cells. So the barrier in your gut is really only one cell thick. It's pretty vulnerable to damage, and it's pretty easy to damage it. And glyphosate does a tremendous job of doing that. So essentially punches holes in the connections, and you have what's called leaky gut, so that these whole undigested protein fragments and other things can enter in and wreck immune damage and metabolic insults. So it can contribute to autoimmune diseases. So it's definitely something you want to limit. And fortunately, you can measure it, even if you think you're eating healthy. You guys, on our site, we have a test that you can measure glyphosate in your urine, actually in your water, too. Oh, you can find out if there's any in there.
Interesting.
So ideally, it should be non-detectable. But, you know, I think overall, Americans have levels that are, I think, almost 10 times that we find in Europe.
Wow.
Where glyphosate isn't banned, but it's labeled, and because it's labeled, people don't buy it as much.
This is anecdote, but this is including myself and many of my clients who were intolerant to gluten or wheat products here in the U.S. would go to Europe, and all of a sudden they could eat pasta and bread and not have the same symptoms. Does that have something to do with it?
The glyphosate may be a part, but there's a lectin in wheat called WGA, wheat germ agglutinin, that is probably likely responsible for most of that, along with gluten too. But when the breads in Europe are typically made by fermenting them with yeast, and the yeast will digest those lectins, and that's probably the primary reason. Whereas that's not done typically in the United States.
Oh, is that why sourdough bread is easier for me to eat than regular bread?
Yes, that's one of the reasons. If it's true sourdough, there's a lot of fake sourdough breads out there, so you have to be careful. Just because it says sourdough doesn't mean it is. I mean, it's one of those, there's so many terms in food that are just absolute lies, you know, and there's no federal regulatory actions to enforce manipulation or deception of those terms. So natural is a common classic one, but even some of these things like Parmesan cheese, and the book Real Food, Fake Food, that goes into great detail in this, written by Larry Olmsted.
Well, you know, it's now that you're saying that, it brings up an interesting question for me. Do you think that we should have more federal regulations, or do you think that they don't really matter?
Well, I'm not a big fan of the federal government in any way, shape, or form. I'm more of a libertarian. So, you know,
love it.
But they do perform some valuable functions, and one of them is to protect the public. That's really one of the few valid uses, at least as I understand, you know, libertarian philosophy, is to protect the public. And one of those could be making sure that they're not corrupted by these corporate influences and essentially rig the system and all the federal regulatory agencies that essentially make them useless, and actually even worse than useless, they're manipulative because they're deceptive. And it's just extraordinary. It seems that the longer a country exists, the more likely it is to be corrupted, and ours certainly has its fair share of corruption, which is possible.
It, it,
premature death.
from my point of view, it's almost like we've already seen how easily influenced they are by special interests. And then what they do is they make regulations that benefit the special interests and knock out other competition all at our expense.
Right. And absolutely.
And so when I hear people calling for more regulation, it's almost like, well, why? They're just going to – you're just going to feed the machine even more, and we're going to continue to get misinformed.
Ultimately, we do need the regulation, but we need the proper type of regulation that's objective and non-biased and not corrupted by these outside corporate controls or influences. So, and that did exist at some times. The FDA used to be a decent agency, and especially when Wiley first was ahead of it in the early 1900s. And then they got thalidomide out. So they've done some good things. They're totally corrupted now.
Now I want to touch the third rail here with you. Something that's extremely controversial over the last few years, and that's vaccines. Now, from an objective point of view, it's hard to argue that the invention of vaccines isn't one of the greatest inventions of Western medicine. However, some people say
I can go further. The CDC classified it as the greatest. No, is that a sport? No, it's fluoridation. But I'm sure they would put vaccinations as one of the best public health benefits of humankind, no question.
Now, I've had people tell me, because I told some people, hey, I'm going to be interviewing Dr. Mercola, and I've had some of them say, well, he's anti-vaccine. Is that accurate, or what would be a more accurate description of your positions?
No, I'm pro-vaccine safety.
Okay. So,
and, explain that. And you just have to look at the reality here. You have Janet Gerberding. You know who she was? She's a physician.
Okay.
Dr. Janet Gerberding. She was the head of the CDC for 7 years in the early 2000s, okay? Do you know what her position is now?
No.
She's the head of Merck Vaccines.
Oh, wow.
One of the largest vaccine production companies in the world. So you've got the same damn thing going on with the drug companies and the federal regulatory agencies and the CDC. The CDC, and now she's the head of Merck's vaccine. Does that make a lot of sense? Does that seem like there might be a little bit of conflict of interest there?
Gosh.
Wow.
So that's just one examination. And I would challenge your initial supposition, which I think is flawed. And I can recommend lots of good material that you can read that
Please
would
do.
Provide the documentation to support that. Susan Humphreys, her first book, which escapes the title of it, escapes me, but just type it in there. And that, you could look on my site. I've interviewed a few times. So.
Okay.
Susan Humphrey, she's an MD nephrologist, one of the few physicians who actually have integrity, because most physicians go in and, with well intention, and they learn all this stuff and they get brainwashed, and then large percentage of them find out the truth, because if they're honest and they question things, they will know the truth. Because these are smart people. When you get to med school, that's the top of the top that they select in there. So these guys are bright. But then they become complacent or are fearful of being ostracized by their colleagues, and they're just afraid of implementing what they find out. And Suzanne was not one of those. She was an MD nephrologist and found that most of her patients were end-stage renal patients in a hospital setting, and they mandated this policy where they had to vaccinate, and she noticed it was prematurely killing her patients or causing very serious damage. I forget the specifics, but she shares that story on my site. And then she just had the courage to go up against them and essentially wound up having to quit her job. And a lot of these people who do, especially in the GMO industry, find the same thing, because the industry, primarily Monsanto, funds almost all the agricultural universities. So they fund all the research. So if you go up against them and try to publish something, which is hard to do anyway because you can't even get the raw material, the glyphosate, unless you have Monsanto's consent, and they're not going to consent to a study that could potentially challenge their position. So the whole system is rigged. And eventually people who do question the truth are ostracized discredited is where we opened up the conversation. So, because all these resources are directed to discredit them. But anyway, Suzanne then took off, and she had a very you know, like most subspecialists in internal medicine, she had a very lucrative career, making hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, essentially going down to making less than a bus driver now, and just writing these books. So, and she goes through the whole specific history. The big ones are polio and smallpox that you would think were primarily a benefit of the result of implementing large or widespread vaccine programs. In fact, when you look at it carefully, it just isn't the case. I mean, and there's, and this is so well documented. But one of, you know, this occurred well over 100 years ago. I think I don't remember specifically. It was in the 1800s for sure. Late 1800s was when a lot of the campaigns started. But there were whole towns who were vaccinated that wound up getting decimated with smallpox, and towns that weren't that didn't. So it has far more to do with the health of your immune system and in following these healthy practices, which were a challenge when many of these, especially around the time of smallpox, you know, people did not have healthy lifestyles, not by choice. It's just because of they lived in these large urban, densely populated areas in filthy situations, poor hygiene, poor overcrowding, really poor ventilation, exposure to all these microbes, not having access to sunlight. So they had a lot of things going against them, poor nutrition. So when you're in that type of environment, you're more susceptible. You have an impaired immune system, and you're going to get these infections. And then when they introduced many of these vaccines, what they failed to do, and actually a really good book on this is another one I would totally encourage you to get. It's Neil Miller, and he reviews 400 scientific studies, a few of which he published, that question this whole vaccine efficacy issue. I mean, it'll just open your mind and blow your mind and open your eyes to the truth that's going on here. So it's a big issue, and you know this one of the central cores is freedom. You know, they're seeking to have everyone do this when and absolutely discounting the fact that there's no potential side effects. I mean, they admit that there's side effects. There's a whole program that's actually paid out billions of dollars to families who've had children either killed or seriously injured from these vaccines. So their sacrifice, it's the greater good is their mantra. And, you know, I'm not, you know, you can make a, I mean, we know who had that greater good mantra too, you know.
That's right.
In Germany.
Well,
but, you know, it's the same type of policy. It's this limited understanding of the big picture, and especially when it's corrupted by corporate influence.
Now, what do you say when we have examples of countries where they don't have a vaccine policy and they've got things like measles and whooping cough, and then we go in and we implement a vaccine policy, and then within a relatively short period of time, they no longer have those diseases?
I'm not familiar with those studies, so I'd have to see it and tease out the details. Most of those studies are funded by the drug company, so you know they know what the answer is before the study's even started.
Okay,
but I could tell you with measles, it's really clear. I mean, that's usually related to vitamin A deficiency. So again, many of these third world countries in Africa, they're dying from measles. Well, what did they need? They didn't need a damn vaccine. They just needed some vitamin A. Their immune system kicks up. It's ultimately your immune system. You have to understand, too, when you're giving some, there's two parts of your immune system. One of the reasons that we have an increase in cancer. Well, actually, it's vaccinations. Why? Because there's two parts. There's just cellular and there's humoral immunity. And what they use with vaccines is humoral immunity, the B cells. So you increase antibodies. That's how you measure their effectiveness. That's how you know if you need to get another shot or not. See what your passive antibodies are. But those are passive antibodies. It has nothing to do. It bypasses the cellular immune system, your T cell system. And when you have this imbalance between T cells and B cells, that is a massive risk factor for cancer. And you are going to get, when you're exposed to this infection normally through the way you typically would require infection. Like I had measles when I was a child. I don't know if any of you guys did, but I had it. My siblings had measles. We have lifelong permanent immunity because both our T cells and our B cells were stimulated concurrently, and that provides permanent immunity. And it also, and when you don't, when you get this passive immunity, it may suppress it somewhat, but then you're going to catalyze the development of resistant strains and mutated strains, because these viruses want to live. They want to thrive. And then you're actually going to make things worse. It's exactly what happened in Disney World a few years ago, which was literally responsible for removing the philosophical exemption in California, which was a massive loss. Fortunately, that was the only state they were successful. They tried to do it in 15 other states, and they lost because NVAC was able to rally up the troops and, you know, and object to this because, you know, they just basically abrogated their freedom of choice and their civil rights.
Would you mind telling our audience what happened in Disneyland? I don't quite remember. I know there was an outbreak, but what was the deal that happened?
Yeah, I forget the specific details. I think it was in March 2 years ago. Maybe it was in February. That there was this relatively small outbreak of measles, and they attributed it to a lack of vaccination. And actually, when they went into further detail, they found out that the most of the people who developed the measles were actually vaccinated. You know, so they didn't even have the facts right, and they used that to leverage this massive effort to remove that philosophical exemption in California.
Hmm. Now, do you think all vaccines are created equal? In other words, are there some that you...
Oh, there are some that are just should not be on at all, I mean, or ever given. The two that I can think of would be hepatitis B vaccine. Given for most infants on the day they're born. And do you know how you get hepatitis B?
Sex.
That's one. That's correct. What's the other primary way?
I don't know. Blood.
Blood. You are correct. So an IV drug abuser, right? So IV drugs or sex. So assuming that a mother
is not a hepatitis
B carrier, the only risk to that infant for getting hepatitis B is IV drugs or sex. Yet it's given on day one when they're most susceptible to harm and damage. There's absolutely no fucking rationalization or justification to ever give that child that vaccine. None. Zero. Wow. And I can't tell you how many kids are damaged from that. I mean, it just makes me livid that they can get away with this shit.
Wow.
And then secondly would be HPV vaccine, the anti-cancer vaccine, right?
Yeah.
So that is... how do you get HPV?
Sex.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So maybe a more rational strategy would be to protect yourself or have... partners that, you know, you can trust or have them tested before you have sex with them. You know, I mean, some simple, it's not like we don't have a solution for this already,
right.
But no, let's give everyone this vaccine, which, I mean, if you want to bring yourself to tears, just go on YouTube and type HPV vaccine injuries and see the lives of these young women primarily that are destroyed, absolutely destroyed from getting this vaccine, just unequivocally.
Hmm.
And you'll just go to tears.
You know,
so,
you know they're giving
the justification is so that you can have people have liberal sex when they have other rational strategies that are relatively easy to implement. You know, these are not rocket science strategies. But no, give them the vaccine. Give everyone the vaccine. Force everyone to have the vaccine.
They give boys the HPV vaccine. In fact, my son went for his checkup. And without really even telling us, they gave him the HPV vaccine.
They gave it to him, right. You know, fortunately, your son's probably healthy because he's your son and he's doing a lot of things right. So, you know, he can survive that assault. But a lot of these kids are not. They fall into the whole trap. They're eating the wrong foods. They're not exercising. They're being exposed to all these pernicious toxins. They're on the Wi-Fi and cell phone. They're looking at blue light at night. So they're susceptible. And they're going to. And these are the kids' lives who are trashed, if not killed.
Hmm. Now, which vaccines would you say you would recommend then? Which ones are okay to get?
Well, you know, that's a decision you have to make yourself. Hmm. You know, I'm for vaccine safety and choice, that everyone should have the freedom to make that decision.
Okay.
And I think it's reprehensible that a parent doesn't do their due diligence because obviously their child can't do that. It's their newborn. Mm-hmm. It's the parent's responsibility. So it's a serious responsibility that most parents don't appreciate. And it's understandable because there's all these pressures from respectable health authorities, public health authorities, and their physician that tell them this is okay, do it, you know, and they don't take the time to research, and who has the time to do it anyway? But I would say to research it, get Dr. Miller, or not Dr. Miller, but Neil Miller's book, Suzanne Humphrey's book, and then look at the other side and make your decision based on you evaluating the evidence, doing your research, your homework. You may conclude it's okay. You may conclude that, well, maybe I'm going to give it to them a little later and maybe just give them one at a time instead of giving them like 15 at once. You know, maybe it makes more sense to do that. So ultimately, it's your responsibility to do that homework, not to listen to me or anyone else. Like, you know, why trust me? Why trust any more than the public health authorities or your pediatrician? You know, but you do the homework. Thankfully, this is the 21st century. This is not the 20th century. You have the tools at your fingertips. When I first was on the internet, I was paying like $5 a minute to search PubMed in the 80s. And I mean, or you can go to the library yourself and do it, which is even more challenging. But, you know, it was really hard to find this information. Now it's easy. It is incredibly easy. All it takes is a little time, effort, and dedication to do it. So do your own homework.
You know, Doc, it took us a minute or two to get you warmed up, but this is what I was looking for. I want to know what else out there right now just makes your skin crawl with that the information that we're giving out there or the shit that we're pushing that people have no idea about that you're trying to stand up and speak out against that just drives you crazy. What else?
You know, you can really get tied up with vaccines, so I tend not to talk about it too much. And I support Barbara Lowe Fisher of the National Vaccine Information Center, who's been doing this for 35 years. She's the co-founder and really is a very articulate spokesperson and incredibly accurate. She has been editing every one of our vaccine articles for like the last 10 years or so. So we make sure that we don't have any incorrect information out there. No one can throw anything at us and say this is incorrect. So, you know, our site is a great source, but I mean, look at others too. There are many of them out there who cover both sides of the issue. But, you know, I support that. I'm philosophically opposed to vaccines for myself and my family. That's the decision that I made based on my evaluation of the evidence. But I'm not opposed to anyone else looking at the same evidence and making a different decision. And they should. It's their choice, their responsibility.
Looking at the looking at the horizon, what are some subjects you see popping up that are going to, you know, that you're going to look into more or might maybe want to start to talk about a little bit that people just don't know about?
Well, the EMF I alluded to earlier is massive. I mean, I've known about it for a long time, but never really fully appreciated the dangers until I got this meter and said, oh my gosh, I had no idea. So maybe pick up a meter if you've got a few hundred extra dollars to spare and need the motivation to physically see it. I've done a video on my site that demonstrates it. But, you know, again, do your own homework. Figure it out yourself. Well, you know, podcasts like these are just tools to help you understand better so that you can get different perspectives. So EMF is huge. So and then you've got electromagnetic interference, which is dirty electricity, which is a result of improper grounding from the electrical substations and creates these high fields in your home. Now, the affected circuits that can cause problems too. And I just was on my site last Sunday, Dr. Sam Milham was 85 years old. And he's still pretty sharp, which is really great. And he's an MD epidemiologist and wrote the book Dirty Electricity. So that's something to consider that we're going to be looking into more. And I like this plant lectins with the plant paradox. I think it's a simple strategy to find true. I didn't have to change a lot of foods in my diet. I eliminated cucumbers and chia seeds because those were plant lectin sources. But most of the other foods I was eating were lectin free.
Now I'm going to be honest, you know, hearing a lot of this information, it's like, oh my gosh, you know, everything's going to kill me. And I've had people tell me this, like I'll bring these things up, maybe not necessarily what you're talking about, but other things. And people will tell them that it's almost like they're just like, well, you know what? Forget it because it looks like everything's
too many things to think about.
They feel overwhelmed. So you just bite off what you can at one time, you know? So you do keto first, you get your diet right. And then you take the next step. Maybe you consider detox or you consider turning off your Wi-Fi at night. Now, why the hell would you need to keep your Wi-Fi on all night long? You know, it doesn't make any sense. It doesn't cost you anything. Maybe you can get a little switch. So, radio controlled switch so that you can turn it off at your bedside. Just have one little button. and then, you know, get a selfie stick. Maybe look a little foolish, but, you know, you're not holding it. I mean, it's simple things. So, you know, plant lectins is a refinement, but, you know, you don't have to go there. If you're having troubles, then consider it. If you, you know, I wrote the book Fat for Fuel for people who are dying from cancer. There are 1,600 people, 1,600 people who will die today in the United States from cancer, and that died yesterday, and that will die tomorrow. That's a lot of people.
Right.
And half of the men listening to this, and 40% of the women will come down with cancer that could kill them. And we're not talking about benign skin cancers. We're talking about the real deal cancer, the big C, that's going to be the number one cause of death in 2020. All right. So that's why this book was written. You know, it, either who's your listeners or someone they know or love is going to face this thing. It's guaranteed 100%. So that's why the book was written. So if you have a serious disease, you want to go in there with full arms. You want to go there prepared, right? You want to give them all the tools and the resources they can have to beat this thing, because you can. Hmm. And I can guarantee you it's not going to be the cancer drugs. You know, people don't know when you have cancer drugs, the oncologists, they get like, this is the only subspecialty in medicine that it's legal for them to sell the very drugs they're recommending. And cancer drugs, as you know, are not cheap. There might be $100,000 per patient, right? And the cancer doc gets half of that.
Wow.
So what is his motivation or incentive to consider recommending diet as opposed to chemotherapy?
Wow.
That's
Doc, you have to, okay, real, because there's so many people that have been touched by cancer, there's probably somebody listening that has it. There's probably someone for sure that's listening that has a family member that's close to them that just got diagnosed with it.
Absolutely.
What?
That's why I said it.
What are the steps that you would say if it was you or somebody close to you, in what order, and what are you telling them right away that's just practical?
I think the most, well, there's two steps. One is to get Fat for Fuel and read it carefully. Read it carefully. I mean, you know, books are, as you know, probably one of the best investments you can get. You know, for under $20, you can get a book that's taken some professional thousands of hours to put together, right, and make it real easy for you. So it's all there. So get that book. And then you can go to my site and look up cancer. I've interviewed a lot of physicians, and there's links to other resources, that clinics, because you need a coach. You don't want to do this by yourself. You want to ultimately, and many of these clinics don't even know how to implement cyclical ketogenesis, but you can do it just by getting the book. So, but get some healthcare professional who's open to this, that can guide you through the process, that can work through it. Because there's other things other than diet that'd be useful. There are a lot of things like high dose vitamin C, which in high doses generates peroxide, which actually kills these crippled cancer cells from the ketogenic therapy. There's things that Dr. Seyfried's working on, like glutamine inhibitors, because people don't really think cancer is just fed by glucose, and that's not true at all. That's why you get cancer cachexia, because when your glucose levels go low, the cancer sends out signals to break down your muscle and liberate glutamine, so that, because it can anaerobically ferment glutamine as easily as glucose. So the glutamine inhibitors are a big thing. Hyperbaric oxygen, glycolytic inhibitors. So, you know, these are other strategies that you can use. And there's a lot of other ones, enzymes, a whole variety of them. But the more things you hit it with, the more likely you are going to be successful. So diet by itself can work, especially in the early stages. But it's not something I would recommend exclusively. I would recommend seeing a professional that can guide through them. There's a book called Best Answers for Cancer. It goes into a lot of other resources too.
Yeah.
There's conferences you can go to. So.
I've also seen a lot of the research on fasting and how effective it can be for cancer. And
But if you're cachectic, that may be counterproductive.
Oh, sure.
You've got to be really careful. You know that you have to be. That's why you need to see someone who knows what they're doing. Now, many people initially diagnosed, they're going to be obese, probably, or at least overweight. So that's not going to be an issue. But in later stages of cancer, it is.
Mm, very, very good point. Have you seen some of the research on cannabinoids in cancer?
Oh yeah, that's another one I just forgot. Yeah, cannabinoids are great. I would definitely use cannabinoids. No, you know, medical marijuana. It's legal in a large number of states, and I don't know if it's the majority, but it certainly is a large number at this point.
It's getting there.
Do you recommend the use of cannabinoids for health or longevity?
Oh yeah, I mean, you know, I wish to hell it was legal. I mean, that's a whole other corruptive influence, but from the industries. But yeah, I would grow it and juice it every day, no question. But I can't because it's not legal where I live. So, but yeah, it would be great. I mean, it's from, I mean, there's even we just posted a study last week where slow doses of THC are starting to reverse Alzheimer's, at least in animal studies.
Wow, that's crazy.
Where it didn't in healthy populations or healthy younger animals didn't seem to have a benefit, but when older demented animals, I mean, they got tremendous improvements with the THC, and not necessarily levels that had a psychological effect. I mean, it could be subtherapeutic, but it just stimulated these receptors that caused this improvement in the cognitive function.
Yeah, I did see those studies. It was like microdosing THC on a consistent basis, and it was able to remove the amyloid plaque that, you know, causes a lot of the problems.
Yeah, simple basics. You know, it's a natural plant. I mean, if you follow ancient ancestral practices, the lifestyles that are ancient ancestors typically were exposed to, and that includes things like moving heavy objects on a regular basis, then you're more going to likely stimulate the pathways that are responsible for health. And then when you do that, disease just disappears. You can't have disease and health at the same time. You get one or the other.
Oh, that's a great statement.
And
we're
going to use that.
It's tough for some people to hear because I guarantee there's some listeners that are going to say, oh, I had a friend that looked very healthy, very fit, exercised all the time, and then they got cancer out of nowhere.
Absolutely, but that's a superficial appearance. They were not metabolically healthy, and there's very specific tests that you can do. A simple one is like high-sensitivity CRP, C-reactive protein. You know, see how much inflammation is your body. Because when you're on a ketones are HDAC inhibitors, histone deacetylase inhibitors, which are radical suppressors of inflammation. So, I'm sure you guys had yours tested, but you want to see it like below 1 and ideally below 0.5. And many of the people are 2, 3, 4, 7 levels, you know?
Wow.
I do notice when I'm in ketosis, my inflammation is just in my joints is definitely lower. And I don't get sore for my workouts like I do when I eat carbohydrates.
Well, since you guys are in fitness, I'll give you guys another hint. Is infrared radiation and red. So red at about 660 nanometers, infrared at about 830 ideally, but 850 would work. And what did they do? There's chromophobes in your mitochondria, the parts of the electron transport chain, cytochrome C oxidase, that resonates with this frequency. And when you expose it to them, it takes that energy, sucks it up, and it makes the mitochondria work more efficiently. So what the hell does that mean? It means that you can improve your mitochondria or ATP generation just by exposing yourself to that, and especially for athletic recovery. And I'm sure each of you guys knows a workout that you can do that you are guaranteed 100% that you're going to be sore as hell the next day, and you may not even be able to sit down without pain, right?
Right.
Without assistance. Yeah. Well, do that workout, and then hit yourself some 850 nanometer infrared, near infrared wavelengths, and you won't have any soreness. It's just gone. I've done it. Like I'll do walking lunges with 70 pounds, you know, to guaranteed to make me not be able to sit down, you know, squat down at all without using some rails, right? And I hit it with the light, and there's nothing.
Now,
it's just incredible.
Where do you get this? Where do you get this light from?
Well, what about like an infrared sauna?
Like a spa?
That's a new thing right now. Is the infrared sauna?
No, infrared. That's far infrared. I said near. The wavelengths are typically 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000, 6,000.
Okay, you gotta
nanometers.
You want
an H50. So it's a cheap way that you can do this. You go online on Amazon, and one's for $69. It's called a security illuminator. I learned this from Michael Hamblin, who's a professor of photobiomodulation at Harvard. And you just type in security illuminators in near infrared. It's 192 LEDs, and it's $69. And the caution, though, is it's designed to be placed outside. It's to light up your patio or whatever so your cameras can see. So you take an Allen wrench and remove the lens, which you don't need, and then you can – there's a green dot at the bottom that needs to be covered with black electrical tape so that it stays on in the daytime. And then you just plug it in, you're off to the races. It's like $70 and it's like 30 watt. And if it was a medical device, it probably cost you $700 or $1,000.
Okay, so how close do I stand to this?
Looks like Ben Greenfield's
ball light
therapy.
Hold it on just hold it right on your skin, wherever you're sore. And it's not going to get that hot. It's not like a heat lamp. heat lamp is a far infrared. When you have a heat lamp, it's like mostly far, only 10% of it's near. So it gets really hot. And that's good for structuring water. And I do a near infrared, a far infrared sauna every day pretty much, because it's great for detox. And there's a lot of other things you can do with detox too. But you, for prophylactically treating or preventing the muscle soreness from workouts, I think you guys will love this. And I mean, it's just the most amazing thing. It's like crazy good. You only maybe need like a few minutes, maybe 5-10 minutes on each site. And you can, you know, the sooner after the exercise, the better. I used to wait and do it till I went to bed at night, but now I just do it right after the exercise, and it just totally abolishes any of that.
We're already ordering it on Amazon as we speak right now. Yeah,
Doctor. I'm gonna test it out. I'm gonna put it to the test, and I'll let you know what I experienced.
Yeah, let me know. Yeah, because you guys are professional athletes. I'm just a professional. Life enthusiast, so I do use strength training, but I don't use it to the extent that you guys do, but it certainly worked for me.
Excellent.
I'm excited.
Excellent. Well, this has been awesome.
Yeah.
Yep.
Thanks again, Dr. McCullough.
All right, we'll be in touch.
All right.
You have a good one.
Okay. Bye, guys.
Thank you for listening to Mind Pump. If your goal is to build and shape your body, dramatically improve your health and energy, and maximize your overall performance, check out our discounted RGB Super Bundle at mindpumpmedia.com. The RGB Super Bundle includes MAPS Anabolic, MAPS Performance, and MAPS Aesthetic, 9 months of phased expert exercise programming designed by Sal, Adam, and Justin to systematically transform the way your body looks, feels, and performs. With detailed workout blueprints and over 200 videos, the RGB Super Bundle is like having Sal, Adam, and Justin as your own personal trainers, but at a fraction of the price. The RGB Super Bundle has a full 30-day money-back guarantee, and you can get it now plus other valuable free resources at mindpumpmedia.com. If you enjoy this show, please share the love by leaving us a 5-star rating and review on iTunes and by introducing Mind Pump to your friends and family. We thank you for your support, and until next time, this is Mind Pump.